someone is vandalizing Montana Rail Link train tracks east of Missoula. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about a program that seems to be helping curb drunk driving in Montana. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock kicks off Montana Public Media's Climate Week, talking with a panel of University of Montana professors about what the next generation of Montanans may face because of climate change. The Missoula County Sheriff's Office is investigating vandalism involving the Montana Rail Link tracks east of Missoula. MRL spokeswoman Linda Frost says the latest incident took place last Thursday when a large obstruction was intentionally placed in the middle of the tracks in the Clinton area.
Well, it was somewhat like a culvert that was filled with gravel, which I don't have the exact dimensions, but it was certainly sizable and very heavy. It did do some damage to the locomotive. When the locomotive hit the obstruction, it flew up and broke the windshield.
The train stayed on the tracks and no one was injured. Investigators found a shovel and a hole dug into the side of a nearby berm. Officers say the hole was concealed with sticks and it looked large enough for someone to hide in. Frost says similar obstructions have been placed on the tracks in the past several weeks in the same area.
There have been a series of them, and certainly a good reason that it has our full attention. We're working directly with the Missoula Sheriff's Department, and we have some pretty good leads on this as this investigation moves forward.
Frost declined to reveal details or a possible motive, citing the ongoing investigation. She says anyone caught perpetrating these sorts of acts could potentially face a felony endangerment charge.
And in other news from around the state, former Senator Ryan Zinke of Whitefish says he's running for Montana's U.S. House seat. Zinke made his announcement today before supporters in Billings. A video of the announcement was posted on his website, www.ryanzinke.com. Zinke says people have lost faith in a federal government that has grown too large and is drowning in debt. He pledged to move a nation toward energy independence and restore the personal and economic freedoms he says the current government has taken away. Zinke is a Republican and a retired Navy SEAL who lost a 2012 bid for lieutenant governor. He joins a growing field of Republican candidates who expect current U.S. Representative Steve Daines to run for retiring Max Box's Senate seat.
Two political consultants are appealing a judge's ruling over campaign documents tied to a secretive conservative group that turned up at the Montana Office of Political Practices. The 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals received the appeal Thursday from Christian and Allison LaFleur. 2 days earlier, U.S. District Judge Donald Malloy ruled Commissioner of Political Practices Jim Murray did nothing wrong in receiving the documents and letting others view them. The LaFleurs say the documents were stolen from them. The documents included campaign materials for candidates in Montana and Colorado that were featured in a PBS Frontline documentary suggesting American Tradition Partnership improperly coordinated with Republican candidates. Attorney Quentin Rhodes said today the LaFleurs are asking the Ninth Circuit to rule they don't have to pay Murray's legal fees.
A judge won't grant former Republican gubernatorial candidate Rick Hill immunity from a possible state investigation into a $500,000 campaign donation. U.S. Magistrate Judge Keith Strong ruled against Hill's argument that the threat of an investigation discourages him from giving the $300,000 left from his failed campaign to the state Republican Party for the 2014 elections. Hill argues that that has a chilling effect on his First Amendment right to free speech. Strong ruled Friday any potential threat to Hill is speculative and remote. The state GOP donated the money to Hill's campaign last October after a judge ruled the state's donation limits were unconstitutional. An appeal in that case and the state's investigation into Hill's donation both have been stayed while the U.S. Supreme Court considers another case with similar issues.
More Montana counties are joining a state Department of Justice program aimed at lowering drunk driving. It's called the 24/7 Sobriety Program, and it requires those with repeat DUI offenses to have their blood alcohol content checked every day in order to avoid jail. Nearly half of Montana's counties have implemented the program since it started in 2011. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says Attorney General Tim Fox wants to keep it expanding.
When the state legislature was considering the 24/7 sobriety program a couple of years ago, lawmakers were given some statistics.
Montana was ranked the highest in the nation for the number of alcohol-related fatalities per 100 million miles traveled.
Attorney General Tim Fox.
First in the nation for the number of alcohol-related deaths per 100,000 people.
Third in the nation for the number of alcohol-related traffic fatalities at 40%. Montana still ranks high in those statistics. Fox says the 24/7 program came from South Dakota. It's part of the broader effort to change people's mindset about drinking and driving.
At its core, it holds people accountable.
We test from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. They have to appear between those hours.
Corporal Brian Merritt works with the Lewis and Clark County Detention Center. He also runs the 24/7 program there.
We are the pilot county.
Lewis and Clark County was the first to sign on in 2011. The way it works is in participating counties, a judge has the option of putting people in the program if they get their second or higher DUI. Those folks have to come into law enforcement twice every single day to have their blood alcohol content checked, once in the morning and once in the evening.
7 p.m. to 9 p.m. every night.
Every test costs $2. Some people only have to do this for a couple of weeks.
And then we've had some folks in the program over a year.
Offenders can also choose to wear an ankle bracelet, which measures alcohol content throughout the day, and then they only have to come in once a week to have their data downloaded. It's more expensive, though. Either way, Merritt says there are pretty strong incentives to comply.
There's instant consequences if they violate. They instantly go to jail. If they come and test positive for alcohol, they go to jail. And nobody wants to do that.
So far, he says 641 people have been tested 64,000 times in Lewis and Clark County. 98% of those tests have come back negative. No alcohol. The Department of Justice says those statistics are consistent with other counties.
It's not common, but it's not uncommon. We get letters and thanks from people saying this is the longest they've been sober.
Merritt does say he has had people reoffend after finishing the program and having to go through it again, but he maintains it's been a very useful tool. Lake County is the latest to join the 24/7 sobriety program just within the last couple weeks. That marks 23 of 56 counties to sign on. Attorney General Tim Fox says Ravalli County is scheduled to begin before the end of the year. He says he wants to try to get as many counties as possible signed up by the end of his term in office. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
A Butte man has died of injuries suffered when he fell from a bucket of an aerial lift. Butte Silverbow County Coroner Lila Bresch tells the Montana Standard that 46-year-old J.F. Bickford died Friday at a Missoula hospital. Sheriff Ed Lester says workers were transporting the lift on a flatbed truck and had stopped to adjust the machinery when Bickford and another man fell from the bucket. Bickford was taken to the Butte hospital, then flown to a Missoula hospital where he died Friday night. A second man who fell suffered minor injuries.
Wolf watchers say they're concerned that hunters may have killed five members of a well-known wolf pack in Yellowstone National Park. Officials with the Wyoming Game and Fish Department say it's impossible to determine if the two male and three female wolves killed recently in a hunt area northeast of Cody were all members of the Lamar Canyon Pack. Recent counts put the number of wolves in the pack at 11. The Jackson Hole News and Guide reports state law prohibits Game and Fish employees from disclosing details about wolves killed in Wyoming's annual wolf hunt. That includes the specific locations where wolves are killed and the wolves' age, coloration, and breeding status. Wolves of the Rockies president Mark Cook says he believes the five wolves killed were from Yellowstone. As part of Montana Public Media's Climate Week, climate change is the focus of our nightly features this week during Montana Evening Edition. Tonight, News Director Sally Mock sits down with three University of Montana climate experts to get an overview of the current status of climate change and the public response to it. Dr. Steve Running is Regents Professor of Ecology and a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that won the Nobel Peace Prize. Dr. Stephen Schwartz is Associate Professor and Chairman of Communication Studies. Dr. Lori Young is Associate Professor of Natural Resource Social Science. Here's Sally.
Dr. Running, I want to start with you. The warnings about climate change have been around for a long time, and so have some of the impacts. But where are we now in terms of the evidence of climate change? And I'm speaking worldwide at this point.
Well, the latest IPCC report just came out a couple of weeks ago. And it went through all the metrics that we've developed over the last decades. The global air temperature of the last decade is the highest on record. Arctic sea ice is one measure that's very well done by the satellites, and 2012 was the all-time record low. And so we're seeing, of course, CO2, atmospheric CO2 going up at actually a bit of an accelerating rate, and carbon emissions still accelerating. And so all the regular measures are continuing on the trajectory we've seen for the last decade. There was a funny little blip of sea level that went down for a year, and of course the scientists found this quite curious, and it turns out it's because there was so much rain in a couple of continents that enough rain was evaporated out of the ocean and then fell on land that they could measure the difference. And, of course, then the sea level rise trajectory started back up. But all these measures are continuing the way they have been for 10 to 20 years.
You've been in Montana a long time. What are we seeing here as evidence of climate change?
The clearest measures we have are our winters getting milder and shorter, and now it's getting rare for Missoula to have a winter night temperature below zero. In the last two winters, we haven't had one night below zero, for example. Our snowpack's melting about 2 weeks earlier than 50 years ago, and that then stretches out the summer season, stretches out the wildfire season, and, of course, has also triggered the big mountain pine beetle epidemics. And the final impact that's quite clear here is that our August stream flows are getting measurably lower, 20 to 30% lower than they were 50 years ago. And so that really says something for our aquatic ecosystems in the small streams.
Dr. Young, these changes have tremendous importance for land managers. How are they responding, and how can they respond to all this?
Well, that's a great question, and one of the key challenges that our public land managers face, Forest Service, National Park Service, is that a lot of our environmental policy is based on the assumption that our ecosystems are fairly stable and predictable, and that if, you know, a land manager goes out and does something, say a silvicultural treatment or, you know, habitat improvement, that there will be certain kinds of outcomes. But with climate change, we know that our ecosystems are changing, and that we may need to change our management style in order to meet our goals, whatever those goals are: biodiversity conservation, providing recreation opportunities, providing for livelihoods, for timber and other resources. And so that means our public land management agencies have to become more adaptable and flexible. They have to be nimble in ways that are challenging for big bureaucracies. And I think that's what public land managers are really trying to get their heads around. How do you retain that flexibility to respond to change on the landscape and to meet public needs and concerns? I mean, the public obviously really cares about these lands. And in many cases, especially with sort of iconic landscapes like Glacier, members of the public are watching to see how they're changing. And so how land managers respond is really important to the public. So they need that flexibility, but also to figure out how to be accountable to the public in that context.
And Dr. Schwartz, how are we having a public conversation about climate change in Montana? Where are we there? I'm guessing we're not in a place that's particularly realistic about it.
I would say it's a mixed bag. There are pockets of discussion here and there. You're starting to see it get explained and connected to the coal export issue, which is emerging in Montana. Some cities are starting to take a more active role in developing climate action plans. But more broadly, I think that this discussion has stalled a bit, and I think that's true nationally as well. I think that reflects partly some of the difficulties of addressing an issue that can be hard for people to grasp. It's hard to point to direct impacts. It also reflects the difficulties of addressing an issue that's become very polarized. I think that makes it difficult for ordinary citizens to feel comfortable talking about it in everyday conversations. It's also difficult to address an issue, I think, that's global in scope, and especially when a lot of the national and global level institutions aren't really demonstrating political leadership about it. If you have a political system that is not engaging these issues, I think most citizens will say, why should I?
Yeah. Dr. Renning, scientists are frustrated by the public discussion of this because they feel like the science is so, and you included, feel like the science is so clear.
Yeah.
And I know you've talked among yourselves about how you can better communicate with the public about this. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, yes, as the fifth IPCC assessment just illustrates again.
Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Right, that all the measures that we've had in place for years, they just keep marching in the same direction. And so to us, this is really a case closed piece of science from multiple measures from the bottom of the ocean to the top of the mountains and up in the atmosphere and just everywhere we look. And so we find it that we don't know what else to do other than show all this information, and yet that scientific information on its own does not seem adequate to get the politicians particularly to have meaningful discussions on the topic.
Of course, politicians follow. They don't lead. So this public discussion, Dr. Young, is crucial, isn't it? And you were saying public land managers, because they see it. They are discussing it among themselves.
Certainly. Land managers are wondering what the public thinks about the changes that are happening around us in Montana and other places around the country and what kinds of actions the public might support. And I think the key really is that we have to figure out how to engage in some kind of deliberative dialogue about the key issues around climate change in order to get past the sort of political morass and polarization that we see.
And Dr. Schwartz, when we do discuss it, should we be discussing it from the standpoint of how do we prevent this catastrophe or how do we adapt to it?
I think that both of those angles on the climate change challenge need to be engaged. The questions of adaptation are certainly ones where I think a lot of ordinary citizens have something to say about that. I mean, moving the discussion sort of beyond the science to get to how do we engage this and how do we address it on an everyday basis. You know, those are questions that all citizens can and should participate in, because any kind of climate policies that we come up with are going to have real impacts on people's everyday lives. The mitigation question is definitely a tougher nut to crack, and I'm hopeful that we can have a more forthright discussion about those, because again, I think there are very potent arguments on all sides of that issue that really need to be thought through. And the fact that we've dwelled on disputes about the science for so long, I think has been to our detriment. It's really held back that discussion. So it needs to take a turn in a new direction.
If the world doesn't take climate change seriously, what do each of you envision life in Montana will be like for the next generation?
Well, what we can project actually fairly accurately is by the end of the century, if we continue on the emissions path that the world is on right now, we will have only a month or two of winter snowpack.
This is by the end of the century.
Yeah. Yeah, by the end of the century. Of mountain snowpack. Probably almost no snowpack in the valleys. We will have, of course, very much milder winter temperatures and simply a lot longer summers. And since we're not seeing any increase in precipitation, those facts then also result in a more arid landscape, in kind of a Utah sort of landscape instead of Montana.
Dr. Young?
I think just building on what Dr. Renning just was talking about, that we'll have less water for irrigators. You know, farmers and ranchers will struggle to have enough water to irrigate hay crops and other crops. There's some evidence that we'll have climate refugees that come to Montana from other places that have even, you know, are even worse off. That will obviously strain infrastructure and provide its own set of challenges and perhaps opportunities. I think, you know, socially we'll be challenged by the strains on our communities that are put on us by changing environmental conditions that really affect all sectors of society.
Dr. Schwartz.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think there is definitely a possibility for increased kinds of conflict over resources. But even more broadly than that, I think it really poses potential challenges to what we might call a Montana identity or Montana culture. These kind of, you know, natural threats to also pose threats to some of our cherished traditions, habits, ways of life, whether that's with work or recreation. And so I think it could potentially sort of upend or force us to really rethink what does it mean to be a Montanan and to live a Montanan life. And so I think that's perhaps could be one of the bigger and broader kinds of impacts that climate change could have, is that it could, you know, fundamentally influence the shape of Montana culture.
I think if we do respond to climate change, that in Montana we end up with a landscape that is producing renewable energy, and we have a tremendous wind resource. We end up with a place where you can hop on a train in Bozeman or Helena and Missoula and head down to Denver or Seattle, you know, as quick as can be. We have healthy agriculture, farmers and ranchers that have efficient water systems and enough water to irrigate, enough water in our streams for trout and outfitters and anglers and tourists, energy efficient homes and lower energy bills. I mean, there's a lot of benefits to effectively mitigating and adapting.
Well, I have been speaking with Dr. Steve Renning, who's Regents Professor of Ecology at the University of Montana, Dr. Stephen Schwartz, who's Associate Professor and Chair of the Communications Studies Department, and Dr. Lori Young, who's Associate Professor of Natural Resource Social Science. I want to thank you all for giving us this kind of overview about climate change and where we are in Montana with it so far. Thank you all very much.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Continental Divide tonight, expect clear skies, lows in the 20s and lower 30s. Tomorrow should be sunny with areas of freezing fog and highs in the upper 50s to mid 60s. Central Montana tonight, look for partly cloudy skies, lows 35 to 40 degrees. And tomorrow should be partly cloudy with highs 55 to 65 degrees. Southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly clear skies, lows 30 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow should be sunny with highs 55 to 60 degrees. And now for the editorial comments from Tom Power.
The Montana Chamber of Commerce recently attacked EPA's regulation of the emissions from coal-fired electric generators. That regulation, the chamber argued, would have catastrophic consequences for both controlling carbon emissions and for the Montana and American economies. These criticisms of EPA's attempts to clean up the emissions from coal-fired electric generators are part of a national campaign by coal interests that asserts that the federal government is engaged in a war on coal. Unfortunately, these critics are massively confused on all the basic facts. The main charge of the Montana critics of EPA's expanded regulation of power plant emissions is that EPA's regulation of those emissions is destroying the market for Montana coal. In fact, however, it was EPA's regulation of sulfur emissions that helped create the market for Montana's and Wyoming's Powder River Basin coal. Because Powder River Basin coal is low in sulfur, power plants around the nation turned to using that Montana and Wyoming coal to avoid the costs associated with capturing the high sulfur emissions that came from burning eastern coals. Without EPA's regulations limiting sulfur emissions, Montana and Wyoming Powder River Basin coal would have remained a huge deposit of low BTU coal located in the middle of nowhere. It was EPA's regulations of sulfur that turned our low-sulfur coal into such a valuable energy resource. The critics of EPA's regulations restricting the emission of carbon from power plants also have argued that that regulation will destroy any incentive for American utilities and coal producers to develop commercially viable carbon capture technology. The opposite is true. If EPA does not regulate carbon emissions, there will be no incentive at all to capture and sequester carbon. No one would have any interest in such carbon capture technologies if they could freely emit all of the carbon they wanted. Just as EPA's regulation of sulfur emissions created incentives for the use of low-sulfur coal, such as Montana's, as well as a market for sulfur removal technologies, EPA's regulation of carbon will have the same effect on the development of carbon capture and storage technologies. Those who see a war on coal being waged argue that EPA regulations are forcing Americans to use more costly fuels to generate electricity, natural gas rather than coal, making us poorer and hobbling our industry and global competition. Again, this turns reality on its head. Coal is losing market share in electric generation in the United States, not because of EPA, but because of low natural gas prices. Those low natural gas prices are a boon to American consumers and businesses. Even without natural gas prices tumbling down and before EPA's new regulations, electric utilities were turning away from using coal because natural gas plants were cheaper to build. They could be built more quickly and in smaller modular units so that utilities could follow load growth more closely. And finally, natural gas plants were less polluting. All of these advantages made the capital costs of building gas-fired electric generators lower than those of coal plants. When natural gas prices also fell to low levels, coal did not stand a chance in the competition. Very few new coal-fired plants were built, even fewer were planned, and the older, less efficient coal-fired plants are being retired because they are too costly to operate. As a result, coal's share of American electric generation fell from 53% in 2001 to only 32% in April of 2012, while natural gas's share increased from 13% to 32%. For the first time, natural gas and coal were providing virtually equal shares of the nation's electricity. EPA's critics tell us that that regulation of power plant emissions is driving electricity costs up as those plants are forced to use more expensive fuel and install costly emission controls. But the U.S. Energy Information Administration data show that over the last 5 years, overall electric prices in the United States have been flat despite the decline in our nation's reliance on coal to generate electricity. Critics of EPA's efforts to control emissions from coal-burning plants point out that U.S. carbon and other greenhouse gas emissions have fallen recently to levels not seen in many years, suggesting that there is no longer any need to regulate those emissions. What is conveniently ignored here is that those greenhouse gas emissions have fallen because the share of our electricity coming from burning coal has plummeted as the nation has turned to using more natural gas, which is much less carbon-intensive, and renewable energy sources. If more coal had been burned, as the proponents of the war on coal hypothesis desire, those greenhouse gas emissions would have been higher. Of course, the Great Recession and the slow recovery from it also reduced energy usage and greenhouse gas emissions. There is no doubt that the U.S. coal industry faces challenges. But if we're searching for someone or something to blame, we should be blaming good old-fashioned market forces driven by the development of shale gas and oil resources, such as in the Bakken region in eastern Montana. But most of the proponents of the war on coal hypothesis passionately believe that markets always do the right thing. That ideological bias prevents them from seeing the strong market forces working against the expansion and the use of coal in the United States. So instead, they have twisted the facts to blame that always convenient scapegoat, the federal government.
Tom Powers is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.